I'm Jerry, Chapter Master of the Adeptus Fanaticus, a chapter of the 40K Fight Club.
And I'm Jason, the creator of the Army Showcase. And tonight, we continue our discussion of the history of Warhammer 40,000 on this episode of the Tabletop Battlefield. Welcome back to the Tabletop Battlefield, the official podcast of the Army Showcase over at www.tabletopbattlefield.com. And in just a minute, we'll continue our discussion of Warhammer 40,000 and its history. This is basically our second part in this series, so if you missed the first part, head back to episode number 7 of the Tabletop Battlefield. The title is called The Librarian Speaks. You can find the first part of this series, which in that we covered the first edition, second edition, and most of third edition, as well as kind of a brief topic of some of the different board games that have been available in the Warhammer 40,000 universe. So Jerry, why don't you go ahead and do a quick summary of just Warhammer 40,000 first edition through third edition a little bit. Can you do that for us?
The quick run over the history. It started with the Rogue Trader. I guess you could call that nominally the first edition. It evolved into second edition with an ad hoc rule set kind of that took a role-playing kind of game, miniature battle game, to the more sophisticated miniature strategy game that we see today and that people aligned more closely with historicals and, with historicals. And then third edition, fourth edition, and fifth edition streamlined the rules to the set that we know today. A lot of angst built up when they moved from edition to edition and actually it was the switch from second to third that caused a lot of angst that people still carry to this day up to the fifth edition. The rules started out extremely complex. If you thought you had rules questions with 5th edition, you should have actually played some Rogue Trader and 2nd edition. There were far, far more. But the game seemed to take on a more kind of hobby quality than it is the competitive kind of environment that we see today. So now I guess we're going to talk a little bit about how the miniatures and other products evolved with the game system.
So you talked last time about in 1st and 2nd edition, the miniature line was pretty sparse compared to what we see today, where you can walk into a GW store and probably have a dozen types of miniatures for any given faction that's out there. And you said also in 1st and 2nd edition, because of that, there's a lot of customization on your part, building the weapons and building the little details yourself. You couldn't just walk in and buy a plasma gun or walk in and buy necessarily whatever you needed. With 3rd edition, how did that change? Is that when you started to see the expansion of the miniature line to the full armies, or was that still coming later?
Yeah, just to make sure that GW, again, has always seen themselves as a miniatures company first. But if you want to put a timestamp with editions, from like the Rogue Trader and 2nd edition days, they were more of the Reaper miniature that everyone knows. They just made miniatures and they had a rule set for people to play and buy more of their miniatures. So as the games, the editions evolved, right, and starting really with third edition is where they sort of backed off of encouraging people buying other miniatures or showcasing other miniatures. You know, the White Dwarf now became a GW only magazine, where before it was just a plain industry hobby magazine. So third edition saw really kind of the hard-hitting, heavy R miniatures and none other approach that GW took. And then, of course, we see now with fourth and fifth the refinement of how their product. So to say that GW is only a miniature company today, I still think that's somewhat true, but very clearly their rules are based on selling miniatures and their miniatures.
So, okay, that kind of finished up against 3rd edition, except actually one more point about 3rd edition before I jump on. That's when we first saw, I believe, the Imperial Armor books from Forge World to kind of showcase their models. Is that my question
yes.
about that?
Yeah.
That's kind of an expansion of 3rd edition. It wasn't ever really an official part, I guess. Well, it's officially 40K, but it wasn't, you know, mainstream tournament thing, but...
No. See, I don't know... The human mind has to put things into categories and make sense of stuff. But quite honestly, Forge World was always, and still always is for the true hobbyist, the guy that's really fanatical about his game, really likes, you know, getting models and doing stuff with it and having some very special rules. Even in my club today, we design our own rules to do things that usually aren't normal. Like we have a hero creation system so that we can have our own heroes go through a campaign and start with, you know, a nub captain and make him end up being a Space Marine hero of some kind. And that's what Forge World, in a sense, is a return to. The rules are outlandish. I've not made any bones about it. I think the whole tournament system of trying to come up with these hard-hitting rules and make tournaments for them is kind of out of place. I don't want to say it's not right, but it doesn't really work because Forge World rules, above and beyond all, are there to have fun. It's therefore to explore more of the world of the Imperium and to enjoy. It's, you know, obviously some combinations are going to be broken. GW knows it. Forge World knows it, but they frankly don't care about it because it's not their concern to make a balanced game. They want to make a fun game. But yeah, we saw third edition come in with the Forge World stuff. And honestly, the books were very expensive. They're very expensive now, but I see more people buying them and I don't really know what's causing that, but the books have always been that way and the bottles have always been that way.
Yeah, I'm looking right here. Imperial Armor Volume 1 was released 2003, which would be the very tail end of 3rd edition.
Yes.
So with that, want to say something?
Well, you saw Forge World rules come models, and then they would always pop rules in the Citadel Journal and in the White Dwarf.
Okay.
So you kind of saw rules, but the books became kind of a place to store them all.
Okay. So let's move on to 4th edition of Warhammer 40,000. This showed up in 2004, and this was basically when I jumped into the game was late 2005, early 2006, and I kind of got really heavy into it when the Tau Empire Codex came out. So talk a little bit about 4th edition. What were their goals? What did they change? Was it this huge change from 2nd to 3rd, or what?
Well, and obviously everyone's mileage is going to vary on this, but and I just have to say this, you know, just a little street cred on my part. I believe I'm the first person in the entire U.S. to have bought 4th edition. They had a Detroit, I'm dead serious. They had a Detroit Grand Tournament. Actually, it was kind of a combination. They called it a conflict. Grand Tournament plus a massive open gaming. And it was the first day, actually it was like the day before the official release of 4th, and they were going to allow any conflict attendee to buy it.
Okay.
And obviously I was there the day they opened. Like I was that night, they were going to have open gaming the night before. I showed up the very moment they opened the doors. I was the first one in line. I bought my 4th edition. And in fact, the guy right behind me was Mike Kasparian, who's known as Fabricator General on the 40K Fight Club boards. He is the second person in the U.S. to be able to buy it. So, that and a dime will probably buy you a cup of coffee. Anyways, yeah, 4th edition. Everyone's mileage is going to vary on how they think it all evolved, but I think Andy Chambers, who was a long time the guy heading up the 40K workshop, wanted to do something a little bit different with the rules, and he made 4th edition. Quite honestly, 4th edition was almost a 180 from where the game was before in terms of the mechanics of how some things worked. Because a lot of us grew up with the 3rd edition, and then near the last year and a half, we messed around with what they call the new assault rules and new vehicle rules. And that actually was a much more in-depth game, much closer to the 5th edition we know now. So 4th edition added a lot of things. It kind of glossed over terrain. It wasn't as much of a factor as the line of sight is today, and it was in 3rd edition. People who think line of sight is a brand new concept are wrong. It's always been there. 4th edition took it away.
So 3rd edition had true line of sight like 5th edition does today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely. And if you think... I think you just got to wait long enough before we start getting the problems with true line of sight. We had some big ones. In fact, that was kind of the centerpiece of all the arguments was true line of sight.
I remember last time we played, you have your Dante figure for the Blood Angels, which is like four times as big as normally it is. Like, how does he work with true line of sight being so big?
That's exactly right. I mean, it quite honestly brings those modeling questions up. I mean, we all had models. You actually saw in 3rd edition a less desire to make some truly dynamic models because people would say, oh, I can see it, so I can shoot it, right? True line of sight.
You got like, his arm way up in the air in victory, and you're like, it's like, well, I can see the tip of your arm, so I can shoot you, right?
Exactly. It was nuts. It got out of control.
Anyway, back to 4th edition?
Yeah, so personally, I really liked 4th edition. I thought the whole terrain aspect where... it was, I guess you could say it was generic. You know, if it's a building, it works this way. I don't care what the design. I don't care if you say it's heavy, light, whatnot. Mm-hmm. It works this way. If your model is X amount of inches in it, you either get cover, you can be seen, and all that. I mean, it was all very kind of clear. Yeah, everyone, you just understood it. Unfortunately, it did leave a lot of metagaming alone. 6-1, half dozen the other. So 4th edition kind of, I think, is a blip. It kind of happened, and we all woke up, and there was 5th edition.
Yeah, 4th edition was 2004, which was 6 years after 3rd edition, and would have been 4 years into 5th edition. Yeah. Now, it mentions here, like, for example, in 4th edition, all the 3rd edition codexes were still valid. So they didn't have to go ahead and redo all the unit stats, right?
Correct. Yeah, I don't, you know, everyone who fears, you know, I mean, how do I say this? The fear that people's armies are going to get nerfed have never experienced a 2nd to 3rd edition switch where you lost your army, quite honestly, and your army was in the back of a book for a while, unless you were Space Marines, of course, because their codex came out weeks later. But every edition after this, they're probably not going to nuke all books. They'll probably nuke one in the switch. They did that in the fantasy. They nuked the Chaos book, but they quickly spun out, three books right after that. So your codex still worked the same. You had some quirks, but quite honestly, all the angst over that, they could be worked out fairly easily. It probably didn't work the way you wanted it to work, the way you're used to working it, but part of the hobby is just trying to figure out new ways to play your stuff. I mean, if the game stayed static for too long, we'd all get bored with it.
So what were some of the big changes? You mentioned a little bit about line of sight and terrain kind of being somewhat generic. Do you remember what the other big changes were? Like, for example, I guess one thing, question would be, you mentioned with 3rd edition, they kind of added a whole bunch of kind of experimental kind of beta test rules that were sometimes played by some groups and some, you know, like some clubs used them, some didn't. Were any of those merged into 4th edition?
No, those didn't survive. We actually see those in 5th edition.
Okay.
I can't really pick them out. I mean, the way close combat works in 5th edition is exactly somewhat how it works in 5th edition. Although the strategic level of close combat in 4th edition was far, far greater, meaning that where you placed the power fist wielding sergeant in your squad and where he ended up in the close combat had impact. If he was leading the charge and he was the first guy in, he could deal greater damage, but yet he could also get really smoked. If he was in the pack, you know, quote unquote, the hidden power fist, he could strike back to some good effect and yet survive the close combat to kind of dish it out in the end on, you know, the big baddie you're trying to get to or a vehicle you're trying to get to. So close combat had a very clear tactical feel to it. And also, I guess maybe one thing that's a progression through the rules that they've gotten rid of is the sweeping advance. And in 3rd edition, when you did a sweeping advance, you quite honestly saw units like Blood Angels and Khorne Berserkers go across the board in a rampage in a couple turns and eliminate the entire army, your opponent's army.
Really?
Yeah, because you would take out a squad, and if you wiped them out in the first turn, you rolled 2d6, that's how many inches you went.
Okay.
If you connected to another troop unit, you fought another close combat in that same phase.
Oh, wow.
So you could literally rampage across the board. 4th edition saw that go from 2d6 to 1d6.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with 5th edition, it's d3 and you can't connect with another squad.
Yeah.
So there was that change. That's probably a positive one. 4th edition was probably much more tactical in that sense. Placement of models, squads, how squads connected in close combat, how they were positioned, actually made a greater effect with things. So 4th edition terrain was much more general, although terrain had a bigger play. You didn't have to worry about it as much, but whether or not you were in cover was a bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
Versus now everyone gets a cover save, so, you know, what's the big deal? Vehicles also had some little quirkiness to them. You know how even on our games, Jason, you and I'll sit there and go, is there a benefit for landing or something like that? In 4th edition, that was a pretty big deal. Vehicles, or skimmers particularly, could hover over terrain.
Okay, yeah.
So now, you know, you can't stop over difficult terrain. You have to make sure you're away from it. 4th edition, you could stop over difficult terrain.
Mm-hmm.
You could land a skimmer so that if it got immobilized, it didn't crash or something like that. So there were a lot of little nitinoid tactical adjustments you could do to units, a lot of little minute decisions you could make.
Do you know if there are any big, like, sweeping changes to how people played their armies from 3rd to 4th edition? Like, you mentioned the whole Blood Angels kind of ripping through armies kind of thing, but was there anything else big that kind of got nerfed, or anything big that got more powerful? Or any kind of overall tactics of how people play the game changed? Stuff like that?
Wow, I can't speak army for army.
Okay.
But yes, there were changes in how people played them. I'm not going to say how they play them. At first, there's always this adjustment, but people being people, we always try to figure out how to get back to what we like. I personally think the game is more about playing the army and figuring out how it works better in the rules and trying to impose your will upon that army and get it to work the way you want it to. Excuse me. But yeah, Blood Angels, they changed. So did Berserkers, but Chaos in general, because of how infiltration got introduced and things like that, you saw armies doing new tricks in different ways. I guess, is that a way of saying it? I guess the one big thing people thought 4th edition did was eliminate the first turn charge, the first turn assault. 3rd edition made it difficult to do. There wasn't all this dynamic stuff of first turn infiltration. Deep striking was completely pointless because you stood a much greater chance on the dangerous terrain when you scattered and you rolled or you rolled doubles, you lost your model. So I mean, oh gosh, what's that? Almost 40% chance of losing a Terminator squad. You're not gonna take that chance. And then even still, the scatter was the same 2d6 scatter. That was a huge risk. So you took two chances of losing the squad, and so no one deep struck. So, and then, like I said, the first turn assault was difficult to do. 4th edition came, everyone thought, oh, look, it's all gone. I can't do it anymore. No, 4th edition just made it easier. But only certain armies could do it. If you infiltrated, A Chaos Army could do the first turn assault like nobody's business and actually win the game. I've actually lost games in 4th edition in the first half of the first turn because of that. And it's actually quite cool when it happens. But 4th edition made deep striking much more viable. At that time, only units that had deep striking and if the mission allowed it, could you deep strike? Well, then it made it, you know, that's pointless as a rule. So then 4th edition said, deep strike's a universal rule. Anybody can do it whenever you want. And 5th edition's capped off on that a whole lot. So, that kind of changed things a lot. You saw deep striking happening a little bit more often. You saw a lot of infiltration. The table became more of a three-dimensional kind of aspect than just, you know, Napoleonic battles lining up on either side and firing at each other.
So now, from my personal experience, I got introduced to the Battle of McCraig set, which was the starter set for 4th edition. In terms of, you know, when I was playing it, I always had a few quirks of the rules. I know, like, for example, some of the measuring range was kind of funky where, you know, it wasn't like 5th edition where you had to have range to one guy, you had to have range, like, all the squad, or you can only do so many wounds to it. And I know some of the things, like, when you had groups of mixed armor saves and mixed toughness, that kind of got messy, because it was, like, majority, except in this circumstance, is a majority armor save, and...
That's what I mean by 4th edition being more tactical.
Yeah.
Mixed toughness came into effect. Like their example was Grotz with a orc handler or master or whatever it's called. So the orc is what, a toughness 4, Grotz like a toughness 3. As long as the majority are of a certain toughness, everybody is. So the orc handler or boss would be toughness 3 as long with everybody else.
Yeah.
Until he became the majority model, or the other toughness became the majority, or it was equal to. The armor saves were the same way. If you have, Black Templars can put scout armor in amongst their Terminators, or they can have a Terminator Sergeant leading a power armored squad. In 4th edition, that Terminator had a 3+ armor save until he was as equal, the models were equal count, or he was the majority of the models.
Were there any of the annoying, like, I mean, do you like that kind of stuff, or do you find that more frustrating, annoying, slowing down gameplay?
You know, it made tactical decisions. I never really lost models to that, but I didn't have that problem. I didn't see it happening with, Black Templars when I played against them or people that had them, but it did drive composition. So you were less likely to, say, take a full scout squad with one Terminator Sergeant. You saw more of a mix, so that, that lessened the impact of that armor save. But I never heard real gripings about it. Excuse me, I often heard, discussion on how to avoid it happening, kind of like, Chaos Dreadnoughts today with them being able to rampage and go absolutely nuts. People will do things like equip them with weapons that won't destroy another dread and put two dreads off to the side and they can go around happy and shoot heavy bolters at each other all day.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I liked it. It was okay. It made, it added a tactical feel to it where decisions of how you organize your squads and where you placed them and what you did throughout the game kind of mattered. Did it impact anything one way or the other? Not really. It, you know, I, fifth edition's come and I don't recall, but I, now that you mentioned it, I'd forgotten about that. Mm-hmm. So, but obviously I don't obviously miss it.
Let's talk a little bit about, some of the expansions that came out in fourth edition. And there were two big ones from what I remember. Being Cities of Death, talking about that first, which was an urban warfare one. That came out, I think, that came out just after I started playing in the 40K. I never bought the book. I played a few games, like, in the GW store, and basically all I remember was the preliminary barrage, where you just basically pound your opponent's guys with, like, off-board artillery in the first turn. Do you remember playing that one at all? Did you
Cities of
book?
Death, I still play it.
Okay.
Cities of Death is a really good expansion. Primarily because of the, I'm drawing a blank now, because of the assets you can take.
Yeah, the strategic assets, yes.
Yeah, the stratagems.
Is that what they're called? I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, they're called stratagems. Okay. Assets are for,
Apocalypse?
Apocalypse.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute.
But the stratagems added a whole new depth to the game. And then, frankly, that was something always, you know, veterans always did, but we always added them into the missions of special rules and so forth. What do you, you know, how do you want to add some kind of creativity to the game? I think where it hangs up with people is that some of the really good stratagems require you to actually do some modeling, and so, frankly, you don't see it. Mm. Not only that, but agreeing with some of my friends is that other than Apocalypse, all the additional books require some setup between the players before they show up and play. It does. Cities of Death does not exactly lend well to walking into your store, seeing a buddy, and say, "Oh, you know, hey, let's just get a game in, man."
Okay. The other big expansion, of course, was later in October 2007, which been Apocalypse, which kind of brought the Forge World super huge battle craziness to the normal 40K line. I remember, of course, I bought that book. I actually pre-ordered it because it looked kind of cool. I actually thought it was something different than what I got, but regardless, what do you think of that? I mean, it's something different to play. I mean, it can be kind of fun. I know I had a few times where for me it was frustrating trying to have like 10 people on a side yelling back and forth trying to organize a battle, but that's more of, you know, how the battle's organized and how Apocalypse plays out. But what do you think about it?
I love Apocalypse. Apocalypse is something I've always done. Most veterans have always done it. I think what's lost is that guys like you have never been exposed to the way it really should be done. And I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. Like what a lot of people experience in the GW store where they get 15 people and let's just play a really big game.
Yeah.
All that really turns out to be is a bunch of people having multiple one-on-one games where you end up just fighting the guy across from you.
Or you just end up yelling at each other.
Right, exactly. I mean, but quite literally, a really good friend of mine, down in Detroit proper, me and him, once in a while, we'll get together and we'll have like a 10,000 point game during a day.
That's pretty
and
cool.
The game is quite literally sit down, we set up, takes about 40 minutes to set up, we go break, have some lunch, come back to it an hour and a half later, sit down, we'll play a game, we'll get a few hours into the game, we'll take a break, go watch some TV, play some video games, maybe run a couple errands that his wife has given him, come back, sit down, finish the game off. And if we get some more people to it, it really takes on the flavor that we're just a bunch of guys pushing models, having fun, seeing what happens. Because you have so many models on the table, you really aren't concerned, hung up on the fact of that one squad surviving. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're playing the regular scope game, losing one squad could mean like half your army. Or, you know, I really don't want to see those models leave. So I think where it loses it is if you're playing Apocalypse and you haven't set it up with your friends who you want to come over, you haven't set up the mission, you haven't discussed with them what you're going to do, what the, you know, the whole mission, the whole storyline aspect to it. You're really kind of losing it because Apocalypse cannot really be effectively played as a competitive kind of who wins, who loses.
Yeah.
And when you get more than at least maybe three people on a side, you do lose all control of everything.
Yeah. And I guess, like I said, it does help have some pre-planning. Like the first game we played at the GW store, it was like Imperium versus the Xenos, or basically versus everyone else. And the Imperium side had five Titans in addition to like 50 tanks, and that was really just a miserable game. It was just, our side just died left and right. You know, you gotta have some kind of planning there to actually have some kind of fun going on, unless you just wanna be constant death and, you know, you just get totally destroyed for 5 hours isn't a lot of fun, but.
Right. GW does not, I mean, it's really not their job in the stores, unless you're a bunker and it's going to be a major event. But I would avoid those games unless you know what you're getting into, which is just going to be, I'm going to put my models on the table and then I'm going to take them off again. Yeah. There are some people that actually set it up that way. They like pounding people like that and have fun, but that can't be much fun.
So anything else you want to talk about 4th edition before we move on to the 5th edition and the current, which is of course the current release of Warhammer 40K?
No, like I said, 4th edition kind of came and went, and no one really remembers it or thinks about it, because I think 5th edition is probably a much more streamlined version.
Mm-hmm. So 5th edition was released in July 2008. I think both of us were at the midnight release party. Did you go to that or not? I know some of the Depismaticus people were there. It's before I actually met you, but.
I don't really remember now. It's been a few years.
Yeah. I know, because you had the signed sheet of paper from, was it Jervis Johnson? Did he sign it?
Yeah, Jervis Johnson and, I think Andy Hoare. That's when Adeptus Fanaticus, actually, oddly enough, the 5th edition release was on the birthday of the chapter. And as kind of a small token, I pulled some connections and got Jervis Johnson and Andy Hoare to sign, kind of a certificate, approving of the founding of the chapter and so forth. It was kind of cool. And I got the store to put them in everybody's 5th edition box set.
Yeah, so like 5th edition then would pretty much be, like I said, a more streamlined kind of, almost, I guess, simpler, sort of, but not really, version of 4th edition. They kind of, except for the line of sight stuff, I think it's kind of messy because they brought back, you know, true line of sight. A lot of the other things were a little bit less strict, a little bit simpler. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, about 5th edition?
Well, a lot of people think 5th edition is more like a 3.5, because it is very much based in the 3rd edition. It's much cleaner, as we said. You know, Deep Strike is now – it's still because of the 4th edition, but Deep Strike is now allowable. With 3rd edition really didn't allow it unless the mission said so. The missions are a lot better. Instead of being kind of structured and dictated to, there's a process to – even though – pitched battle is a pitched battle. It has sort of the variations because you have different deployment methods. The seek and destroy. You had some little variations on the theme to it. So there was always a little bit of a difference there. Fifth edition, I guess to me, the major revamp, I guess assault, because now the whole armor save issue is not a problem anymore. The mixed armor saves, mixed toughnesses. And then, of course, terrain, line of sight is brought back. A lot of people thought that was a great thing, but I think that's mostly by people who don't remember the angst we had in 3rd edition over true line of sight. What else to talk about on 5th? Maybe a testament to how good 5th edition is I have never actually read the rule book.
Really?
If you can believe it. Yeah, I've never actually read it straight through. Because the rules are still very much very similar to 3rd edition. And of course, in 3rd edition, you couldn't survive without having that book with you. Fifth edition, it also cleaned up things like, how do you measure units? That's always been a question. People still have that question today, and it's actually pretty well called out in the book here. It kind of stopped major leaks in the 3rd edition, like the sweeping advance. That's kind of been nerfed.
Well, I guess not nerfed, but it got rid. I guess kind of got nerfed because you can't sweep in advance another unit now. That's kind of a downer.
And that's why, you know, I still get that rage of that urge, like, all right, I'm going to crush somebody. And it's like, oh, I only get D3 inches and I can't even touch you.
And now you got to stand and get fired at for a turn.
Right.
Some of the new rules were like the go to ground ability where you can, if you don't have like an armor save or the armor, you know, armor piercing is too high, you basically drop down and try to give yourself a improved cover save, voluntarily pin yourself. That's something I never personally ever used very much, but it's there, I guess, a different option. One of the big things though was the ability to run. Now the fact that before you had a fleet of some sort to actually, you know, run your D6 inches during the shooting phase. Now, everybody can do that. So some of the, like, Tyranids, for example, you know, if they're big, giant monsters, those can charge at you, and that can be a bit scary because they can come at you faster now. A few things like that. Also, ramming's new. That was something that, was that ever in 3rd edition, you remember? To be able to ram vehicles?
No, ramming always was like a special mission rule, like or fighting in a scrap heap or something like that with the orc mission. They had that. But yeah, running, that's a favorite joke of mine. I used to play Eldar around the 3rd and 4th edition time frame. So when this came up, I was like, wow, all right, now everyone gets to feel the humiliation of rolling a 1. Because fleet, when I used to gripe about the low toughness, low armor save on an Eldar warrior, they said, yeah, but you get fleet, of which I would always roll 1 on. So now everyone felt that pain. But yeah, I mean, cover saves are now abound.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Hey, I mean, you can just get one just by looking at our model weird. but there is a lot.
All kinds of stuff, yeah.
Yeah. I would have preferred them to tone down weapons a little bit more. Cause like everything can AP or kill you now. So, oh my gosh, I just would rather that have gone down a little. And you know, actually, you know, one of the big things that changed also were defensive weapons. In 4th edition, defensive weapons were anything like strength 5 and
that's
below.
That's right, yeah. So you'd fire those in addition to your main weapon all the time. That hurt a lot of people.
Oh yeah. I mean, ball predators were just awesome. With heavy bolters on there. I mean, you fire everything. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's strength 4 and it's like, gosh, what's strength 4? My storm bolter. Well, I could fire that anyways. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I think defensive weapons are kind of pointless anymore.
There were some other vehicle changes, primarily the damage table. We went from, like, 2 separate tables, one for glancing, one for penetrating down into 1 condensed table. And the process made vehicles a little bit more survivable because now normally, under most circumstances, you can't kill a vehicle with a glancing hit, whereas you could before in 4th edition. So that helped a little bit of that kind of way.
Yeah, that was a lot of people suspected that would happen when Apocalypse came out. And, of course, they were right.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about some of the expansions for 5th edition, because there were actually about 4 so far, and it looks like another one's coming out in July. The first one was Apocalypse Reload, which I never bought that one. That's pretty much just bringing up some of the Apocalypse rules of 5th edition, right? Do you remember that? Did you get that or not?
Yeah, that it was kind of 2 things. When Apocalypse came out, right after that, they came out with a whole slew of PDFs. So they packaged them in a book, and then they updated kind of some of the rules to 5th edition. So, yeah.
Okay. Then there's Planet Strike, which I think was last July.
Yep.
That was about doing planetary assault missions. It had 6 custom missions, or 6 new kind of missions to it. Each one had kind of a super deep strike thing going on. I honestly never ever played a Planet Strike mission. I never found anyone who wanted to play it. I have the book, I read through it, but I never got around to playing one. Did you ever play that much?
Yep, I've played it a few times. It's a deadly book.
what do you mean by deadly?
Well,
lots of stuff dies.
Yes. It's kind of like a miniature apocalypse. Some of the missions, if you're on the defensive side, you're just gonna get smacked by a lot of incoming artillery. So you, again, this is one of those books that you actually have to set up with your opponent. Mm-hmm. Cities of Death, not so much. You could actually just throw a bunch of cities down and go for it. It just gets better if you set up and orchestrate the battle. Planet Strike, it most certainly has to be because the terrain actually plays a bigger piece. Somebody actually has to have a fortress or actually has to have I got a moth in here. This is nice. You actually have to set it all up before you play. Otherwise, you're just going to get hammered.
So that's more along the lines of try to make the game fun and crazy than necessarily a tournament, nice standardized rule set, right?
Yeah, you can't play that one in a tournament at all. There'll be people that try, but it really loses its context. I think any expansion is for those that want, like if you're playing a campaign and you want to have models, you know, an army deep strike onto a battlefield, this is the rule how you do it. Or you could recreate one of the best books that they did, one of the novels they did is called Storm of Iron, how the Iron Warriors are assaulting an Imperium Bastion. And you could recreate that one.
Okay. Let's move on to the next one, Planetary Empires. This has pretty much brought the Mighty Empires thing from Warhammer Fantasy into the Warhammer 40K universe. I believe it came with a bunch of little tiles so you can kind of build a 40K plan with a little hive cities and some other fancy terrain on there. Did you buy this one?
Yeah, I got that one too.
Okay.
What did you think of the rules for it? I was like, where are the rules for it?
Were there rules in it?
One page. If you've played the Fantasy Empire battles, I was disappointed a little bit because I was hoping they did something a little different. But all they did was take the Fantasy version and reshape it to be 40K. So while it was cool to have the tiles, I could have just bought another Fantasy set and been just as good. Mm-hmm. I have a different, I guess it comes from my hang-ups with campaigns of that kind in general, because campaigns are supposed to be about playing the game, not playing a meta strategy on a map. Mm-hmm. And when you have something like that, you've got to, in order to make it very successful, you have to have a bunch of people that are willing to commit the time and effort to play it. If you don't, the map campaign breaks down.
Yeah.
Conversely, if you design a campaign to just be a way to play more games, you tend to have a much better campaign because that kind of version takes far less time to manage and to do. By way of example, I've mentioned it on this podcast before, how they did something called the Warhammers or the General's Compendium for Fantasy. And it is a magnificent book for any hobbyist. So lots of stuff in it to do, some great rules, some great stuff. And they even give you a campaign, a very detailed campaign set to do, going down to seasons and days and stuff. And I know a group that did that. I mean, they had a very elaborate system, and they made a map that was as big as a wall of a house. And it sat in the wall of their store, and the store manager did it. Nobody knew where anybody else was but the store manager, and they had a big map. He had little maps for people to mark with their locations. And it took them 6 months to get to 3 turns.
Oh, wow.
And they quit after that. Mm. So I don't know how much fun that was for anybody.
So let's move on to the next expansion, which was the one that just came out maybe about a month ago, Battle Missions, which had something like 36 or so additional scenarios based around the various armies. You could play like, a Tau Pacific mission or an Eldar one or a Space Marine one. I know we played a few missions from that one. What do you think about that book?
I like it. It's some of the missions are a little like, what am I playing this for? Mm-hmm. Other ones like one of the Tau missions you and I played, wow, I want to play that one again because it, like, rocked my world.
Yeah.
And then the mission me and you played the other night, that was very reminiscent of a meat grinder from third edition where your troops get to come back. But for the most part, I really like it. I like how they've taken a story aspect to the missions. Unfortunately, I think that book is better suited, again, for a bunch of guys to set up the game before you show up and play it. Mm-hmm. Some of the missions you and I, once again, playing that game, I wanted to test out a certain Blood Angel list. The battle mission that we randomly rolled for would have nerfed any of the things I wanted to try out and see how they work.
Yeah.
So you really kind of have to go into it with that. Otherwise, the book is really good. I like the story aspect to it. It makes for a good read at night. And the missions are pretty good. I mean, of course, if you break it down from a tournament point of view, they're all kind of the same, but it's the special rules. I mean, there's only so many deployment ways you can deploy. There's only so many ways you can do objectives, but it's the special rules they layer on top of each mission that make it unique.
Yeah.
You know, you take a standard 12-inch deployment on either side with, a hill in the center, and you either add deep strike or you take away deep strike, the mission becomes different. It's a different mission. Just whether or not you want to complain how different it is, but the point is that it is, in fact, different. But overall, I like battle missions.
And if I could say only one kind of complaint about the book is that they could have made it a lot thinner. Because, any given mission, about 90% of it is basically core text from probably one of the standard missions that shows them in the 40K rule book. There's a lot of, repeating how long the game lasts or how long you deploy and stuff. I mean, I understand they want to make each mission self-contained, but like I said, there is a lot of repeated text from page to page in that book.
I guess it depends on how you look at it. I mean, I, for one, get tired of flipping through the rule book when something's not repeated. It says reference this page. Mm-hmm. They could have probably been saving you from here's universal rules for missions. Yeah. And then you get this, now reference the front page. Well, I can just photocopy that one page and everything's right there.
Yeah.
The other thing in that Battle Missions book, if people don't know, is a revamped kill team.
Oh yeah, the very end, yes. Yep.
And I really, really like that. The original kill team missions, even from the White Dwarf, was kind of a good thing. It was fun. Don't get me wrong. I played it. I really loved it. But even I, trying to integrate it into campaigns and try to get more fun out of it, modified the rules, somewhat to the extent they did. But the kill team missions prior to this were nothing more than the brute player or the opponent player that wasn't the kill team ended up being a spectator for the game. He just moved the models for the kill team player. Mm-hmm. So this one actually allows two people to sit down and play a game with a small number of models. So I really like it. I think it's fun. I want to play some more of it.
So while I finish up here, just a few minutes left. If you had to pick, what was your favorite style of transition? Was it from like first to second edition where it kind of had two rule books merged together? Was it second to third where you pretty much overthrew out the entire game and got a whole new game with all new stats, all new rules? Or do you like the more of the third to fourth to fifth edition where it's a few small changes without drastically requiring you to buy all new books and things? What's your favorite style of how they did in the past and why?
I think it might have been third to fourth, mostly because of the excitement. We were all excited for a new edition. We'd lived under third for almost 6 years, and we never thought they'd ever do one. We just thought they would layer out rules on top of rules with chapter-approved White Dwarf and stuff like that. And a new edition was welcome. It was exciting. It was fresh. Fifth edition, unfortunately, was kind of like, oh, we were excited, and we couldn't wait to get it. And they made a big hype about it. But when we got the book, it was like, okay, what's so cool about this? So the fourth edition, while the rules were a little more clunky, it was a much more exciting release. It was fun. I mean, I remember when I got it that first night, even though I had to get up at 4 a.m. the next morning to go to the grand tournament, I stayed up all night and read the book. I was dead tired that first day of the GT, but I wanted to stay up and I wanted to be the first one to read fourth edition. But fifth edition, like I said, I look at the rules, the quirks, and it's probably part of the reason why I can't, and I have a problem with, like I've said, the rule bleeds over in my head. So that's why I have to always refer back to the book. But, fifth edition, I just don't feel like sitting down and reading it from cover to cover. Because I already know, I know a lot of the changes. I just have to go and figure out the nuances when we have a rule question on the table.
Okay. I mean, I guess in my opinion of that, I kind of like how they do it from, say, third to fourth to fifth, where pretty much all the old codexes still work. You don't got to go out and buy a new codex to get all new stats. I guess the one thing I wish GW was a little bit better at, and I think they don't do this because it kind of reflects back in their whole we're not a tournament-focused thing, is if they had a little bit better releasing, like, FAQs, address issues. I know, for example, it's kind of a shame of self-promotion of an article I wrote on the Army Showcase talking about the future of the Tau Empire, kind of looking back how the changes in 4th and 5th edition caused, a little bit of messy stuff with our Codex rules. And, well, GW kind of addresses that a little bit. There's still some outstanding issues they never addressed. And it kind of leaves, every tournament having their own FAQ. It would be nice if GW was a little more clear about that kind of stuff. But I do like, the fact that the rules editions don't require you to buy, like, a whole bunch of new stuff.
Yeah. The thing you have to always remember is it's in the acronym Frequently Asked Questions. And unfortunately, if GW think it's isn't frequent, they're not going to answer it. Sometimes they think something is very basic and it comes from your perspective of the game. And again, GW isn't out to make a competitive board game like Risk or something. They're there to make an enjoyable time for you and your friends to sit down with a beer and have fun with. So they're not going to. They very well could dive in and tweak something and make it much more usable, but they're not going to.
Yeah. I noticed you compare that to, say, like Privateer Press or WizKids, who had both very tournament-focused games. They both do – well, WizKids not anymore because they don't exist. But when they did, they had, really frequently updated, frequently asked questions. Like every month they came on new stuff because they tried to run a tournament-focused game. I think you're right. Just kind of different attitude to how you run a company.
Yeah, it's just a different approach. And as you can see, people that like tournaments have responded to that. And they're like, okay, well, that's the game over there. We're going to create a tournament aspect to it. So they've got the that independent thingy, FAQ thing, the INAT, and they've done that. And that's fine for them. I just think it breaks down when people expect that's the way you play it, and that answers everybody's problems. It doesn't. It fits well for a tournament scene. but unfortunately, what you get from that is watered down codexes like people complain the current Chaos is. So you got to be careful what you ask for.
All right, well, that's about 45 minutes here, so we can go ahead and let you go because I know you got to take off. Any
yes,
last
sir.
Comments you want to say before you go?
No, but just a little cross promotion if you don't mind. The 40K Fight Club now has a podcast to talk about 40K fantasy, GW hobby, and all in the context of the 40K Fight Club. You know, Jason being part of the chapter and the Fight Club yourself, you know, eventually we'll get you on and talk to you as a hobbyist. But yeah, check it out at our website at 40kfightclub.com.
Go ahead and send me a link. I'll put it in the show notes. So,
all right, we'll do that.
Let's go ahead here. Any questions or comments, send them to me at jason@rockosoftware.com. That's rockosoftware.com. And of course, follow me on Twitter, tt_battlefield. Also, get this ice cube, I have my mouth here. Also, if you want to play any, like, online games, Steam username is Rocker Robotics. And I finally got into the StarCraft 2 beta. So I don't know what my username is. It's like Jason dot, I think it's TT, like, B field, because they got really weird limitations. I couldn't type in either Rocker Robotics was too long, and so was TT Battlefield was too long as well in their username field, drove me to the wall. So I got some really funky username. If you want to take me out of StarCraft 2, not very good at it, but we can try it. So, Jerry, what's your Twitter?
My Twitter handle is MyGeekyLife, MyGeekyLife.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for coming on. You want to go ahead and sign off?
All right. Thank you very much. I'm Jerry, Chapter Master of the Adeptus Fanaticus. Shut up and roll the dice.
And I'm Jason. We'll see you again in about 2 weeks on the next episode of the Tabletop Battlefield.